Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to this week's broadcast from River of Life Fellowship Church in Copenhagen, New York. This week, Assistant Pastor Abel Larkin shares with us the example of David and Solomon's lives and how the ripple effects of our decisions we make now affect the people and generations that follow, with a message titled, Your Legacy.
So, a couple weeks ago, I spoke on sufficient grace. And since then, it was, okay, what am I speaking on next? And for some reason, God put Rehoboam in my mind. And if you don't know the story of Rehoboam, you'll hear a little bit about him this morning. It's not a great story. I mean, it's a good story, but it's not a very happy ending for him. And I didn't quite know where to go with that. I just started kind of thinking about it. And then circumstances kind of played into the story a little bit. I was talking with Ashley at one point a week ago or so, and I said, sometimes we have these messages with pop culture references or current event references, and a couple years down the line, you know, they don't make as much sense anymore. Now, at the risk of doing that again, I'm going to bring up another current event. So a little over a week ago, or over the past week, you might have seen this meme going around because of something that happened a little over a week ago at a Coldplay concert. And I'm not here to make fun. I'm not here to shame anybody. But basically, if you didn't see the story, good for you for staying off of any form of internet because it's everywhere. But if you didn't hear the story, there was a CEO of a big tech company, astronomer, was at a concert, a Coldplay concert, which apparently still happened. I didn't realize that. And he got caught on the kiss cam with a woman who was not his wife. And ironically was the head of HR for his company. So he's the CEO, she's the head of HR, and they get caught on kiss cam. Now, again, like the five people at the Coldplay concert probably wouldn't have made a big deal about it, but somebody caught it with their phone and realized what was happening, because as soon as they were caught on kiss cam, he like ducked out of the shot and she turned red and like ran away, and then it flashed to the person next to him who was like hiding her face because she apparently knew everything that was going on. And somebody caught all this on their camera and started sharing it. And even the lead singer of Coldplay, I don't even know his name. Somebody probably does. Chris, something Martin. Chris Martin? Yeah? Okay. We got a Coldplay fan up here. Poor guy. He's a Vikings fan too, so pray for Joe. All right? He kind of figured out what was going on. He's like, looks like somebody might be having an affair here. And it became a meme, and it went all over the internet. Now, this little-known tech company, I had never heard of Astronomer before, but it's apparently a million-dollar company, like millions of dollars, like huge. And he's been the CEO for a few years, and he's been building it up. Building up this legacy that he could leave behind. He built this company into a strong competitor in an already highly competitive business. Now, his net worth is somewhere between like $30 and $70 million. Well, about half of that now. But that was his net. I'm sorry. But this is what he was building. This is the legacy he was creating. This is what he hoped to leave behind for his kids, because he's got two small kids. Now, aside from the money that he's going to lose, here's what else is at stake. This is, I found a CPA posted the statistics online. He has two children who are now twice as likely to drop out of school, three times as likely to experience domestic violence or instability, four times more likely to suffer from mental illness. His son will have a 35% higher chance of divorce. his daughter will have a 60% higher chance of divorce. His son just learned how men treat women, how they keep their promises, how they honor or don't honor the mother of their children. And his daughter learned that love is conditional, promises can be broken, and she's going to remember that for the rest of her life. No matter what he built with that tech company, no matter what fortune he built up, no matter how hard he worked to provide for his family, this is now the legacy he leaves behind. The moral example we leave for our kids is way more important than whatever material legacy we think we are creating. So I want to ask you this question. Are you casting a shadow or shining a light? Some of us know what it's like to live in somebody else's shadow, whether it's a parent or a mentor. We know what it's like to live in somebody else's shadow who has built up this legacy that we just can't possibly live up to. And some of us are so busy trying to build that for our kids that they're just lost in the shadows ahead of us. Right now, we have a society that's obsessed with what they're building. Their buildings are casting shadows. Now, this isn't new. And it's not just happening outside the church. Christians aren't immune to this. When we look in the Old Testament, we see some of the greatest heroes of the faith, some of the most amazing people, and the shadows that they cast over their children and future generations. Start with the easiest one. David. We talk about David as one of the greatest heroes in the Bible. Like, I want to be a David. Minus a whole bunch of stuff later on in his life. Like the slaying the giant thing, pretty cool. Fighting a lion off, that's awesome. Right? And he did do a lot of great things. But then he had this thing with Bathsheba. And he sinned by committing adultery with Bathsheba. And then when she became pregnant, to cover it up, he sent her husband to the front lines so that he would be killed. And this was bad, right? That's a bad thing. But the shadow that he cast is much longer than just that. It's much longer than just a single failing. So David, if you read the whole story of David, you find these little tidbits that don't quite make it into the highlight bio of his life, right? This isn't like, you know, what he puts in the about section of his Facebook profile. Unless he's got eight of them, one for each of his wives. Because he had eight wives. That's a lot. Okay, that's a lot of wives. Nothing compared to his son, but that's a lot of wives. And of those, he had at least 20 kids with those eight wives. At least 20 kids, which is a lot of kids. Those are just the ones that get named. He could have had a whole lot more. Now, there's nothing wrong with a big family. I mean, 20 kids is a lot. I mean, I guess if you got a palace to put them in, it's okay. The problem, though, with 20 kids is when it comes time, especially when you're king, comes time to pass on the inheritance, and all of a sudden it becomes, who's next in line? There's some difficulty there. But David, for all of his great things, all of the great things that he did, and all the things that we admire him for, did not do a fantastic job shepherding and discipling his kids. They had some serious problems. I'm not going to read the whole story of Amnon, his son Amnon, and his daughter Tamar. They would have been half-siblings. I'll let you read that. It's in 2 Samuel 13. Let's just say Amnon did some very appropriate things with his half-sister Tamar. But Absalom, another brother, found out about that, and he wasn't very happy. So Absalom's solution was to have some guys over for a barbecue, including Amnon, and in the middle of the meal, just have a bunch of guys stab Amnon to death. That was his solution. And what did David do? Nothing. We have no record of David actually correcting Amnon or Absalom. What did happen is after Absalom killed Amnon, he's like, okay, I might be in trouble. I'm just going to go off into exile in Geshur for a couple of years and hide out in case dad really gets ticked off or one of my other brothers gets ticked off. And so he hid out. Now, Joab, one of David's commanders, said, listen, your son, he really wants to come back. He really loves you. How long are you going to keep him exiled? And so David said, yeah, bring him back to Jerusalem. Absalom comes back to Jerusalem. He's there for 2 years before he even sees his father David. David never goes to talk to him, never goes to punish him, never goes to correct him, never goes to confront him on what he did. Here's what happened. Here's the first interaction they had after the incident. And Absalom answered Joab, behold, I sent for you, saying, come here, that I may send you to the king to say, why have I come from Geshur? Why am I even in Jerusalem? It would be better for me to still be there. So, now let me see the king's face. And if there is iniquity, let him put me to death. Now that's a bold statement. The dude was on the run for murdering his brother. Let me see the king, and if there's any iniquity in me, let him put me to death. There's probably some iniquity in you. So Joab came to the king, that's David, and told him, and David called for Absalom. Thus he came to the king and prostrated himself on his face and lay down flat on his face and humbled himself to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. And that was it. Well, that was it for that part of the story. That was it for the confrontation with Amnon. That was how he treated Absalom after he punished Amnon. Now, I'm not suggesting that, you know, you killed your brother, let's put you to death. That doesn't necessarily fix everything. But to welcome him back in, not confront him on anything? What does Absalom learn from that? Well, I guess dad didn't have too much of a problem with what I did. Let's see how far I can go with this. So what did Absalom do next? Absalom decided he was going to take over the country. You know what? Dad's getting old. I think I'll be king next. And so he set himself up near the city gates, and when people would come in and say, you know what? The king doesn't really have time for you, but I will judge you. I will rule on what you need. I will help you out. I'll take care of everything. And eventually, so many people came to Absalom, so many people sided with him, that they started to declare him king. So much so that David fled Jerusalem, ran away, because there were so many people that supported his son. Now, Joab, the guy that kind of helped out Absalom a little bit, ended up betraying him, and against David's wishes, killed Absalom. It's kind of a crazy story. Absalom got all his hair caught in a tree while he was riding a horse. That's why I keep my head shaved. Got all his hair caught in a tree. The horse kept running, and he's just kind of hanging there by his hair. And Joab and his men come up and fill him with spears. Joab did not follow orders very well. Joab was, you know, kind of on David's side, but he didn't follow orders very well. Joab did a lot of things that David did not want him to do. Joab tried to promote one of David's sons that wasn't supposed to be king. And what did David do about it? Well, David's reaching the end of his kingship. He's about to hand it off to another son. And this is David's solution for the Joab problem. This is great. So he's talking to his son Solomon on his deathbed, which I don't know why people buy deathbeds. That doesn't make sense to me. But that's where he is, and he's talking to Solomon, and he says, "Now you also know what Joab the son of Zeruiah did to me, what he did to the two commanders of the armies of Israel, to Abner the son of Ner, and to Amasa the son of Jether, whom he killed. He also shed the blood of war in peace." In other words, he killed people when we weren't at war that he shouldn't have killed. He was a scoundrel. "And he put the blood of war on his belt about his waist and on his sandals on his feet. So act according to your wisdom and do not let his gray hair go down to Sheol in peace." In other words, he's a big problem. You take care of him. He wants to hand the nation over to Solomon as he's close to death. Now remember, as David's close to death, he's got 20 kids. A couple of them are dead now, but he's got more. And he's planning to hand the nation off to Solomon. His other son, Adonijah, not a big fan. Adonijah wants to be king. Guess who sides with Adonijah? Joab. Joab and Adonijah work together, and Adonijah basically declares himself king. And Solomon's mother comes to David and says, "Hey, wasn't Solomon supposed to be king?" And David said, "Yeah, that was the plan." Well, Adonijah's making himself king. Okay, so here's what you do. Adonijah and Joab did not succeed. Solomon was made king. But this is the very end of David's life. This is how Solomon's starting his reign, with brothers that want to rebel against him, with a commander-in-chief of the army that's siding with all of his other brothers. Things do not look great for the start of Solomon's reign. Instead of shining a light, David cast a shadow into the beginning of Solomon's reign as king. He left all sorts of messes for him to take care of. Solomon began his rule by having to deal with David's enemies. He had to start his kingship with bloodshed instead of peace, because David wouldn't do what was necessary. And so that's how Solomon's reign started. He took care of the Joab problem. But then he also made some mistakes, because Solomon had some lofty goals. Solomon had a palace to build, and he had a temple to build. Now, building a temple to God is great. How you go about it is important, though. So what did Solomon do? He started by taxing the people. Solomon had 12 deputies over all Israel who sustained the king and his household. Each man had to sustain them for a month in the year. And Solomon's provision for one day was 30 cores of fine flour and 60 cores of meal, 10 fat oxen, 20 pasture-fed oxen, 100 sheep, besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, and fattened fowl. That's a lot. Now, you'll notice I skipped some verses in there. The verses that I skipped are the names of all of the deputies. I didn't want to try to pronounce them all. Okay, you can read them there in 1 Kings chapter 4. So this was his plan. He basically split the kingdom up into 12 districts, put one governor in charge of each district, and said, "This is what you're going to provide me each day. And you each get 1 month of the year." So, when you do the math, because that's what I do, 30 cores of fine flour. What the heck is a core? I don't know. But when you translate it through all of the other measurements that we do know, it adds up to about 8,700 pounds of fine flour a day. Today's money, that's about 1,600 bucks. 60 cores of meal, that's about 20,400 pounds, about 3,700 bucks a day. Plus the 10 fat oxen, 20 pasture fed oxen, 100 sheep besides deer, gazelles, roebuck, and fatted fowl that they give them every day. That's a lot of tax on a little nation. People didn't really like it. And when the taxes weren't enough to get the job done, because he's got this big building project, he needs the work done by workers, so he puts them to work. In the next chapter, we read, King Solomon raised up forced laborers from all Israel, forced laborers, and they numbered 30,000 men. And he sent them to Lebanon, so they were deployed. 10,000 a month in shifts. They were in Lebanon a month and 2 months at home. Well, that's not so bad. Okay, but that's still 4 months a year you're going to be gone. And Adoniram was over the forced laborers. And Solomon had 70,000 who carried loads, 80,000 hewers of stone in the mountains, besides Solomon's 3,300 chief deputies who were over the project and who ruled over the people who were doing the work. Now, all of this work was for the temple of God. That is great. And that probably helped ease the sting a little bit. Yes, we're doing this labor. Yes, it's hard. Yes, we're away from our family 4 months a year, but we're doing it for God. You know how long that took? 11 years. And when they were done with that, they got to work on his palace. At least they got taxed for the palace. The work that the Israelites did for his palace was less. He got people from other nations and enslaved other people to do that. So although the work was worth it, it really stressed the people. They weren't too pleased with Solomon. Add to that Solomon's marriage issues. David had 8 wives. Solomon said, watch this. I'll have 700 wives. That's like one a day for 2 years. I can't imagine the marriage ceremonies. That's ridiculous. And when the 700 wives weren't enough, he got 300 concubines. Side pieces, what they'd call them today. It's the girl that he doesn't want to quite commit to and marry, but, you know, he keeps on the hook. I can't imagine that's a healthy household for a kid to grow up in. Can you imagine having 699 stepmothers? Can you imagine having 700 mothers-in-law? Oh. I hope mine doesn't watch this later. But with all that time with his wives and his concubines, how much time do you think he actually spent discipling his kids? How many kids do you think he had? How much time did he spend discipling the son that would be the king after him? We called Solomon the wisest man to ever have lived. And in a lot of ways he was. He wrote thousands of proverbs. He's a very wise man until it came to his personal relationships. And what happened was, when you have that many wives, you want to keep them happy. Especially because they talk to each other. And so if one of them's unhappy, pretty soon a few hundred of them are unhappy. And so he did everything he could to keep them happy, including building idols and temples to all of their gods. Because these women weren't Israelites, at least the majority of them. They came from other nations. He married them to strengthen alliances with those nations. And when they came in, they brought their gods and their worship of those gods with them. And Solomon did whatever he could to keep them happy, including walking away from the one true God. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the detestable idol of the Ammonites. And Solomon did what was evil in the sight of Yahweh and did not follow Yahweh fully, as David his father had done. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable idol of Moab, on the mountain which is east of Jerusalem, and for Molech, the detestable idol of the sons of Ammon. Thus he did for all his foreign wives who burned incense and sacrificed to their gods. Molech was the one that was famous for child sacrifices, by the way. He built all of these within Israel, that close to Jerusalem. What do you think his son learned from this? His son learned lowered standards for his own relationships. And you know what? If that one's not working out, just marry another one. And another one. Solomon married for alliances and to satisfy his own desires. A woman's relationship with God, or at least the God of Israel, didn't really make it high on his list of qualities that he admired in a woman. It really was about, how can this help me politically? Or how can this help me personally? What his son might have learned is that pleasing your spouse is worth compromising your relationship with God. Not a healthy ingredient in a marriage. And yet we still think today it's okay to date and marry someone who doesn't share our faith. Look what it did for the wisest man on earth. It could be just the first domino in the chain of horrible decisions in a relationship. And this is what his son learned. And as goes the king, so goes the nation. It started with Solomon. These are the compromises he made. These are the choices he made. And it went with the rest of the nation. They began to wander away from Christ. Well, the God of Israel. You might say Solomon built the temple. The people during his reign saw that the worship of Yahweh was important. That's true. That's true. But let's think about that timeline. In the fourth year of his reign, the foundation of the house of Yahweh was laid in the month of Ziv. Now in the 11th year, in the month of Bul, which is the eighth month, the house was completed throughout all its parts and according to all its plans. So he built it in 7 years. From foundation to completion, 7 years. He started at the beginning of his reign, 11 years. So even if they were only being exported as slave labor for those 7 years, that's a total of 28 months that each one was out. But this was the first 11 years of his reign that he dedicated to the building of the temple. And so if you want to make the argument that Solomon saw Yahweh as important and the people would know that, well, they did for the first 11 years of his reign. Anybody know how long Solomon was king? 40 years. That means 28 more years of his reign that he could undo the good that he had done. Let's put that in today's perspective. That's 7 presidential terms. How much good can be undone in one? And he took 7. 28 years ago, yeah, you weren't even born, all right? 28 years ago, Bill Clinton was president. It was 1997. You think America's changed a little bit since then? Do you remember this scandal with Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky? Remember how big of a deal that was then? And how little that kind of thing is thought of now? I'd say America's changed a little bit. And Israel can too, in 28 years. When the temple was completed, Rehoboam, the king after Solomon, Solomon's son, was 13 years old. Those first 13 years, he would have seen the beginning of his father's reign and the temple being built. And then he's got 28 years development from 14 to 25, where psychologists say that cognitive thinking starts to finally solidify and people really start to form their ideologies. That whole time frame, he's watching his dad marry woman after woman after woman, build temple after temple after temple to foreign gods. Yeah, he started out his reign okay, building the temple of God, and then he moved further and further away from that. And during that 28 years, the nation builds up bitterness towards Solomon for the taxes that he imposed and the labor that he forced on them. And they do all of this while simultaneously drifting away from God, following their king. So by the time Rehoboam takes the throne, the nation of Israel is 40 years removed from David's death and has dealt with three kings over the last 120 years. Three different kings over the last 120 years. A lot of change can happen in that time. We get tired of politicians a whole lot faster than that, and we know that they got a chance of changing over in the next 2 to 4 years. They dealt with kings for 40 years at a time, at least the first few. After that, they didn't last nearly as long. Now, this isn't an excuse of what Rehoboam did or said, which we'll get to in a minute. But I'm just setting the stage here. Just think about what he's learned from his father and what his father learned from his father. Rehoboam is two generations removed from David. What some would consider one of the greatest heroes in the Bible. This is his grandson. Solomon at least started out good. Rehoboam, not so much. So, Rehoboam's put in a difficult situation. Instead of his father and his grandfather shining a light on his reign, they cast a shadow. They've cast this legacy of immorality and burdened the people with a whole bunch of taxes. And when Rehoboam takes over, instead of thinking to change something, living in the shadow of Solomon and David, he does what so many of us do and thinks he's got something to prove. And so when Rehoboam takes over, he goes to Shechem. For all Israel had come to Shechem to make him king. And it happened when Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, heard of it. He was living in Egypt. Nebat sounds like a great name for a mobster. You can guess how he takes care of his enemies. For he was yet in Egypt, where he had fled from the presence of King Solomon. Then they sent and called for him, and Jeroboam and all the assembly of Israel came and spoke to Rehoboam, saying, "Your father made our yoke harsh, but you now lighten the harsh service of your father at this heavy yoke which he put on us, and we will serve you." Then he said to them, "Go for 3 days, then return to me." So the people went away. So for context, Jeroboam had been prophesied to become king. And because he feared the king, because he feared Solomon and who would come after Solomon, he fled to Egypt. But he's come back because Solomon's dead and Rehoboam's taken over. And the people come to Rehoboam and say, "Listen, your dad was really, really hard on us. Ease things up just a little bit and we'll follow you forever. It won't be a problem." Rehoboam has basically three choices here. He starts by consulting the elders in his inner circle. He took counsel with the elders who had stood before his father Solomon while he was still alive, saying, "How do you counsel me to respond to this people? What do you think I should do?" And they spoke to him, saying, "If you will be a servant to this people today and will serve them and grant them their petition and speak good words to them, then they will be your servants forever." So he can make things easier on them. Do exactly what they asked. Make them happy. That's choice one. Choice two, he could do nothing. "You know what? I appreciate what you're saying, but we really need those taxes. We're going to keep them the same. I'm not going to make them worse, but I'm not going to make them better." That's choice two. Choice three, he listens to his buddies. The young men grew up with him. The young men who grew up with him spoke to him, saying, "Thus you shall say to this people who spoke to you, saying, 'Your father made our yoke heavy. Now you make it lighter for us.' Thus you shall speak to them, 'My little finger is thicker than my father's loins.'" I'll let you interpret the subtext there. "So now my father loaded you with a heavy yoke, but I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions." So choice number three is make it harder on them and prove to them that you're tougher than your father. And which path do you think he took? He took door number three. His ancestors had cast a shadow, and his way of getting out of it was being tougher than they were. He descended even deeper into darkness. Things didn't go so great for Rehoboam after that. because they did exactly what they said they would do. Israel rebelled, and Jeroboam, as prophesied, was pronounced king over Israel. Well, 10 tribes of Israel. Because of God's promise to David that he would always have an heir on the throne before him, Rehoboam held on to 2 tribes, Judah and Benjamin. Judah, because he was from the tribe of Judah, Benjamin was the smallest and weakest of the tribes. And they stayed at war for centuries with each other, with foreign nations. They went through calamity after calamity. They were captured and exiled by Babylonians and by Persians. They were invaded and occupied by Greeks and Romans. And we look back and we go, you know, Rehoboam was really dumb. Why would he do that? And yes, we all make our own choices and we all suffer the consequences of our own choices. But Rehoboam was also a product of his upbringing and the example that his father and his grandfather set for him. Eventually, the palace and the temple that Solomon built were torn down until not one stone was standing on top of the other. Everything they had built was destroyed. Even in Rehoboam's lifetime, much of what Solomon had filled the temple with, the articles that had been built, the gold basin and the gold shields and the gold spears, they were captured and taken off. Rehoboam gave a lot of them away to keep from being invaded. They didn't even last through his son's kingship. What Solomon built was torn down. Now we know the end of the story. Jesus came and redeemed it. But there's still no temple. There's still no palace. The temple that was built after was not nearly as grand as Solomon's. So why do I tell this story? Why do we bring this up? Because we are all building on a foundation we didn't lay. We are all leaving some sort of legacy behind. Whether you have kids of your own or not, you are leaving something behind for future generations. Both in your personal life, what you build personally through your own job and your house and your family, but also as Christians, the legacy of faith that we leave behind for others to follow. Paul puts it this way in 1 Corinthians 3. He says, according to the grace of God which was given to me, like a wise master builder, I laid a foundation, and another is building on it. But each man must be careful how he builds on it, for no one can lay a foundation other than the one which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now, if anyone builds on the foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, each man's work will become evident. For the day will indicate it because it is revealed with fire, and the fire itself will test the quality of each man's work. If any man's work which he has built on remains, he will receive a reward. And if any man's work is burned up, he will suffer loss. But he himself will be saved, yet so as through fire. What are you leaving behind? What are you building on what you've been given? What are you doing to shepherd the next generation? Well, I'm living an example of a godly life. That's great. And they're watching that example. They're watching every example that you set. What are you actively doing to build on that legacy? What are you actively doing to acknowledge and correct the failures that they see happen? Because we all fail. David failed. Sure, did he ever sit down with his son and say, listen, buddy, here's what went wrong for me. Here's how you can avoid it. Solomon wrote down thousands of proverbs. Did he ever sit down with Rehoboam and say, listen, you're going to be king soon. Here's what you got to remember. Here's what I did wrong, and here's what you can fix. I find it interesting when we read this. Paul says, anyone builds on the foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, each man's work will become evident, will be tested by fire. Only a few of those are going to survive the fire. Gold, silver, precious stones. And you know what those three do that the other three don't? They reflect light. Everything else is going to be burned up. It's going to undermine everything you've built. What are you incorporating into your legacy? You can work as hard as you want. You can make as much money as you want. It's not going to last. It doesn't reflect any light, and it can be gone in a moment. Are you making choices today that future generations will be proud of? That you want them to emulate? Are we going through our lives with conscious thought that, oh, I don't want to do that because my kid's going to see it and my kid's going to do it? Are you making choices you want your kids, you want those people after you to emulate? Are you teaching them what you learned or just hoping they're paying attention? Because like I said, they're paying attention to everything. And if you're not actively instructing, then they're going to learn everything. The good and the bad. And you only get to hope that they choose the good. Solomon learned some lessons about being a husband and a father from David. He saw what David did, and he expanded on it. Do you want your kids seeing what you do as a model or as a cautionary tale? You can't trust that they will figure out which is which. You have to take the time to teach them. Rehoboam could read his father's writings. He could watch the decisions he made. But did he learn how to apply that wisdom to his own life? It seems he didn't. He lived in the shadow of his father. And so my challenge to you is to ask yourself, are you casting a shadow or are you shining a light? Let's pray. Father, the only light that we have is a reflection of you. The only good in us comes from the grace which you have given us. Comes from your Spirit at work in us. I pray, Lord, that you would equip us to reflect your light to those that come after us, to those that are watching us, whether they're our kids or our coworkers, or our neighbors, or just people on the street. Father, that you would equip us to reflect your light. Lord, that we would be conscious of the things that we are building, the legacy that we are leaving behind. That we wouldn't approach it carelessly in hopes that something good would be made of it. But that we would surrender it to you to be tested and proved to be worth gold, silver, and precious stones. We pray that you would help us to pass on to the next generation the truth of your word and the wisdom to apply it correctly. We ask that you be with us this week in each decision we make, that we might glorify you in our actions and our words. In your name we pray. Amen.
Hey, thanks for joining us. We're glad you could be here. Remember, if you'd like to hear more, watch our service live on Facebook, YouTube, or visit our website at www.riveroflifechurch.org. Also, mark your calendar for community tent meetings with the ministry Gospel Express on Wednesday, August 20th through Thursday, August 31st at Maple Ridge Center in Lowville, New York. Every evening, starting at 7 p.m., will be music from various singing groups and a message from Christian evangelists Nelson Koblenz and Dave Miller. Friday evenings, after normal service, will be youth events that will be held from 9:30 to 11:30 p.m. Bring your family, friends, and an open heart to be blessed and be a blessing to others. Have a wonderful week. We'll see you next time.